have you ever done amateur radio? Now, don't you be pointing at me, saying, don't you do it every day for four hours each day. Amateur radio, as in the hobby of amateur radio. It's a technical hobby that uses designated radio frequencies. Can you tell I've copied and pasted this? Dedicated radio frequencies for the non-commercial exchange of messages, wireless experimentation and self-training. You even have to take an exam and get a licence in order to be able to operate on the air. Andy Jenner has done just that. We will be having a chat with Andy. Is that a 10-4? Good buddy? I think it might be. CB radio, is that kind of different again? Apparently, amateur radio, ham radio, has had a bit of a resurgence thanks to the TV show that, I'll be honest, I haven't actually seen. The one that was very popular on Netflix, Stranger Things, in which they use ham radio to connect to another dimension. Now, that might be a leap too far, but there's a possibility, if you are someone who knows what you're doing with the amateur radio, you may well have linked up with another continent, certainly another country. Who have you met when you've been doing the ham radio? I'd love to know who got you into ham radio as well. Who got you into the amateur radio? What was your first radio set like? Have you sort of grown it over the years? As I say, we're going to be talking to Andy Jenner, who knows what he's doing with it very soon indeed. But if you've got a ham radio story, 0800 678 1566. Are we allowed to call it ham radio? 81333 is the text number. Start your message with the word Somerset. You can email somerset@bbc.co.uk. We're on the WhatsApp, 08000 321 333. I'd love to know who you have connected up with, where in the world, and how.
Simon Parkin. BBC.
Now, it is always a very dangerous trick to try and pull off when you try and sound like you know what you're talking about when you got no idea what you're talking about. So, CQ. This is Bravo, Bravo, Charlie, Radio Somerset, standing by for a call. I suspect with head in hands, Andy Jenner is saying, oh, heck. We're talking about amateur radio today. The Radio Society of Great Britain say that more and more people are signing up to the hobby. To find out more, let's call in Golf 7 Kilo November Oscar. Andy, good morning.
Good morning to you, Simon. Thank you for having me on. And just a correction on the call sign, it's Kilo November Alpha.
Oh, curses.
We'll put that one down to QRM, I think.
Hang on. Or is it that we put the wrong person? We were going to talk to someone. Anyway, listen, thank you so much for your time. You are someone who understands amateur radio and has been doing it for years. How did you get started?
Well, it was kind of something that was in the back of my mind almost since I was at sort of secondary school. But getting back in the sort of early, or late 70s, early 80s, getting licensed was quite tricky. Getting the courses and things was quite tricky. So I didn't actually get my license until the end of 91, beginning of 92. So I've been licensed since then. So it was basically fulfilling something that had been in my mind for some time. So I sort of picked up the interest, I guess, from just reading. I mean, you know, back in, you know, so when I was at secondary school, you know, reading about electronics, reading electronics magazines, bits and pieces, amateur radio seemed like a logical extension of those interests. But as I say, getting into it took me a little bit more time than I expected, I think, to be honest with you.
Well, I mean, there's lots to break down there. Obviously, you look at the world we live in now, and communication could not be simpler. If you are a small person, you can communicate with your friend around the corner, you can communicate with someone on the other side of the world just via something that is in your pocket for much of the day. You don't have to go back that far to a point at which we didn't have mobile phones. We had landline phones that we were never allowed to use because they were so expensive. And you know, it's not that long ago that not everyone had one of those. So to hear a voice come out of nowhere via a magical radio set must have been mind-blowing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's still a fascination, even now when we make contacts. When you think, you know, what I've got is I've got a box of electronics on my table in front of me here attached to a piece of wire in the garden that you know, is sending a signal to, you know, anywhere in the world potentially, you know, somebody at the other end with another bit of wire or a bit of steel or something up in the air and another box of tricks is hearing me, decoding that, and then we're talking back, and we're conversing with absolutely no infrastructure in between us. We're not reliant on on internet cables. We're not reliant on mobile phone masts or anything like that. It's completely point to point.
Can you remember the first connection you made with someone and how exciting it was to ask where they were or whatever?
Well, the first connection I actually made was extremely local. I literally had my license, and the first piece of kit I had was a small handheld radio, which is often the way that people come into the hobby because it's a relatively low-cost route into the hobby. So I was only using local VHF transmissions, and I worked through what we call a repeater, which is a piece of amateur-supported equipment on a hilltop that helps extend your range for a mobile station or a handheld station. And I made my first contact through the local repeater, and I was absolutely as nervous as anything. I got it completely wrong. I was using tones in the wrong places and all sorts of technical things. But the person I spoke to was really nice and really kind and told me that I was sending tones on every transmission rather than just the first transmission, and explained all these things to me and helped me. And it was just such a nice way of being introduced to the hobby.
When I mean, obviously you've been in it for many years, since when you first connected with someone who was kind of millions of miles away, what was that like?
Oh, that was great. I mean, strangely enough, the first transatlantic contact that I had was quite some time into my radio career for a variety of reasons. Cracking the Atlantic for the first time was great. I worked a station in New York, and I was actually setting up in Bristol at Bathurst Basin to do a demonstration station for the Cabot Cruising Club's Bathurst Basin Regatta. And I literally got set up. I just fired the radio up and all the equipment up, and I sort of tuned around, and I heard this conversation going on. And I caught the end of the conversation and called the station in New York back, and he came back to me sort of on the second call. And that was absolutely fantastic. And what a way of talking to people or demonstrating amateur radio to people when they came wandering up to, oh, where you worked, you know, what you managed. Well, I've managed New York and, in fact, Rotterdam, which was the second call afterwards. So it was, you know, really, really sort of mind-blowing. And you still get a buzz out of it, even after you've done it a few times.
When you find somebody...
Hello.
Oh, hello, are you there?
Yeah. Oh. I've got you back. Okay, sorry.
I was just saying, when you link up with someone, whether it's in Rotterdam or New York, do you only ever talk to them the once, or do you then, can you sort of meet up with people regularly?
There's all sorts of sort of protocols or ways of doing that. I mean, some stations you will just work occasionally, once or twice. Some stations you'll build a relationship with them, you'll build a friendship with them over time, and you know you'll arrange to talk to them on regular occurrences. And you know, many hams have gone and travelled to foreign countries to meet up with the people that they work that they've spoken to, where they get sort of long lasting friendships out of it. So it can be a whole mixture of things. Some people just want to make the contact, 2 minutes, 3 minutes on the air with somebody. That's it. Thank you very much. Nice to work back into the UK again or something. Other people will sit and talk for 10, 15, 20 minutes. And you build a lasting sort of friendship with them.
Let's talk about some of the bits that we perhaps know are there but don't understand. So you mentioned there it took you a while to get your license. So you have to have a license. You cannot just buy something and plug yourself in.
That's absolutely correct. The license structure has changed since the days when I took mine. There's now a three-tier incentive-based license system that's being run now. So the entry level is the foundation license, which is a really good and easy way in, and it opens the hobby to so many more people than the old style what we call the old style radio amateurs exam, or RAE, does. And young children young people can take the exam now. Retirees can take the exam now. It's very, very straightforward to get yourself in and get your first license and get on air. We've got a young lad at our club, 13, who's taken his foundation with his father, and he's sailed through it. It really is a hobby that is accessible now.
And we mentioned in the introduction there the Stranger Things, the TV show.
Yes,
he's partly responsible, they reckon, for a bit of an upsurge. I've not seen it myself, but apparently they use the radio sets to link to another dimension, which might be a bit of a stretch. But have you seen young people? Like you mentioned there, your friend's 13-year-old. Have you seen younger people getting into it?
Well, we see it. Yes, certainly. Often, I mean, in Seth's case, he and his father decided together they wanted to come into it. Obviously, in some instances, the hobby is elsewhere in the family, and the children pick up on it, earlier perhaps than they might otherwise do. But we're trying to do outreach to try and actually introduce people to the hobby. I mean, our club is going down to Southfield Primary School in British Science Week in March to actually do an amateur radio demonstration day for some of the children there, so they can actually see what the hobby is all about. So there's a definite encouragement to try and bring young people into it, and it's reaping rewards, I think, to be honest with you. And any coverage is good coverage, I suspect, is the situation. But when you see something like Stranger Things, and like you, I haven't got a Netflix subscription, so I haven't seen the show either. But when this sort of thing actually hits sort of mainstream and becomes part of the consciousness, that can only be an asset, quite frankly.
There is a lovely quote from someone. We saw a story in the Times about Professor Catherine Mitchell of the University of Bath, who has been using the help of the amateur radio community to help her research the upper layers of the atmosphere, because they obviously deflect radio signals around the world. And so she knew that there was a wealth of talent out there that could help her on her way. And then that led to a piece in the newspapers. And there is the most lovely quote from one of your colleagues, one of the team, who said, people ask why you can do it when you can communicate with anybody using the internet. He said, it's the difference between walking up Mount Snowdon and getting a helicopter to the top, which is a lovely way of summing it up, isn't it? Do you find when you go out and meet young people who perhaps won't have any idea about it, and they, you know, they live in a very high-tech world, they still get the charm?
I think they do, yes. And I think the interesting thing is how much of the current technology that we take for granted relies on the same principles of radio that we are still using. Whether it's high frequency stuff for Wi-Fi and mobile phones, or just broadcast radio and bits and pieces. It's all the same technology. It's all the same theories. So what you're putting into action with amateur radio is the stuff that commercial operations are already using. Like the BBC, for example, or indeed, your mobile phone masts or everything else. They're just another form of radio. The difference is that they are, they reach further now. They've got more infrastructure and things. And communication has changed dramatically in 20, 30, 40 years, as you said earlier. I can remember mobile phones coming in. I don't know whether you can or not, but I certainly remember mobile phones appearing on the market and then being ridiculously expensive in the size of handbags. Mm. And we've seen crossovers in technology. Technology that in some cases has been researched or sort of initially sort of propagated by enthusiasts like radio amateurs. The interesting thing is that if you go back in time to when we were getting allocations in the radio spectrum as a hobbyist experimental hobby. Lots of the bands that we were given were actually bands that the commercial broadcasters of the day thought were useless, thought they couldn't use. So they said, give these guys this, get them to play in the corner and out of our way. And we actually made them work for worldwide communication. And all of a sudden people came back, well, actually, there's a way of using this. Perhaps we should have some of this spectrum back, And this is this ionospheric skip that you were talking about that Catherine Mitchell's been talking about. I've met Catherine. She's extremely, extremely knowledgeable in her field. Professor at Bath University, and she comes to many radio clubs in the area and gives talks on the research that she's doing at Bath University. It's very 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 interesting stuff that she's working on.
Oh, I can imagine. The when we introduced you, Golf 7 Kilo November Alpha, yes. codes and all of that kind of stuff, how does that all work?
They've come into common usage. A lot of the codes that we use, I mean, the phonetic alphabet, obviously, that we use for the call sign Golf 7 Kilo November Alpha, that's phonetic alphabet. That's used as an aid to communication. That's used when you're working in conditions when the bands are quite difficult to hear clearly on. You use phonetics because they're there to spell things out. It's the same reason that the military and the police and other authorities use phonetic alphabets. It's for clear transmission, error-free transmissions of information. But a lot of the codes that we use, I jokingly said at the beginning, we'll put the missed letter down to QRM. QRM is what we call a Q code for man-made interference. And a lot of those go right back to the days of the telegraph. systems, Phillips codes and things like that, where shorthand was being employed to save sending things, you know, over long distances with long dits and dahs being transmitted. Codes were developed, and those codes have sort of stayed over time, and that actually made the transition from Morse code to telegraphy, and then, you know, more wireless Morse to spoken word.
I remember being of an age where CB radio suddenly became a thing. And I guess it was kind of movies like Smokey and the Bandit and BJ and the Bear on the telly and stuff. And we heard codes being used in that 10-4 Good Buddy and Smokey's on the Tail and all that kind of stuff. Is that different again?
It's again, yes, it's different again, I suppose. You know, we've got a lot of people in our club who have come into amateur radio through CB. It's a very interesting sort of proving ground, or certainly was, you know, around the time it was legalized. It became a very good sort of a recruiting ground. In fact, the call signs that were issued around that time, the block of call signs that coincided with the legalization of CB, that we issued those in 18 months, which is an astonishing amount of time, astonishingly short amount of time to actually issue a block of call signs from. But yeah, you know, there's very good similarities between it. You know, again, it's a box. It's an electronic box. It transmits. You need to know about your antenna. You need to know about how to match the system together to make it perform properly. All of these things are common to amateur radio and CB. The differences between amateur radio and CB is that we have a greater allocation of allowable frequencies, which means that we can change our sort of range and propagation characteristics and response to noise and things by moving to different bands and different frequencies. We've got access to different modes, more modes perhaps than are available on CB. And we have greater power as the result of being a technical hobby with an examination involved in it. We're allowed greater powers than is permitted on CB. So there's similarities and differences, I suppose, is the best way of doing it. But we find that CB can be a useful sort of recruiting ground for people who want to actually then, they've dipped their toe in with CB, which is relatively easy to get into. You don't need to pass an exam or do anything with it. You get in, you start playing with it, and then you realize there's more beyond that, and actually then you come to the various local clubs or somewhere, go online, get your training schemes, and you know, sit your exam and then move into amateur radio that way. So it's very much an allied part of the wider hobby, I suppose, is the best way of looking at it.
The Radio Society of Great Britain is an organisation where you can find out more. RSGB.org is the website, and Andy, you are a member of it, obviously. Before we let you go, when a voice has crackled through from nowhere, what was the most interesting call that you can remember? Who's the most interesting person that you accidentally found yourself speaking to?
I don't know about interesting person. You know, most of the people I've not had the fortune to run across some of the celebrity hams who are around, because you know, back in the day, King Hussein of Jordan, for example, was licensed, and you could actually end up speaking to him. You know, some of the astronauts on the ISS are licensed, and if you're lucky and you get the right time of day, you can talk to them. I think it's difficult for me to point to pick up a celebrity that I've worked, but key points that stand out for me, I think my first, as I said earlier, my first transatlantic contact into New York was one that sticks in my mind regularly, and I recount that story in various training sessions that I run at our local club when I'm doing foundation and other, indeed, training for other exams and bits and pieces up there that we do. I think the other one, I worked into Australia on a digital mode, which is a keyboard-to-keyboard computer-based mode. And I did that a few years back from Lundy Island in the Bristol Channel, which was a wonderful location to be in at the time. So those stand out in my mind as the sort of contacts that I will always come back to when people say, "What's your best contact?" or "Did you do this?" or "Have you done that?" or "How far have you worked?" kind of thing.
Brilliant. Well, look, thank you so much for your time today. Am I allowed to say 7-3 to you?
You're absolutely allowed to say 7-3 to me, and the same to you too.
Okay. You better just tell us what that means.
That means best wishes.
There you go. Well, with that, have a lovely rest of day. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you very much, Simon. Nice talking to you.
Andy Jenner, pleasure talking to you. Golf 7, Kilo November Alpha is his call sign. And as I say, the RSGB, the Radio Society of Great Britain, loads of information out there if we've sparked your interest. Maybe you've already had the interest for many years, in which case, tell me, please, about your amateur radio experiences. Tell me, did you happen to find King Hussein of Jordan one day? Were you connected to the ISS, perhaps? 0800 678 1566. Use an old-fashioned form of technology called a telephone to give me a ring and let me know. You can text us 81333. Start your message with the word Somerset. We're on the email, somerset@bbc.co.uk. We're on the WhatsApp, 08000 321333. Where did the voice that crackled through the airwaves originate from that caught you by surprise?